Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, we are celebrating 250 episodes today. Wow.
250.
What's something that you've done 250 times that you love this much?
Nothing.
Not even making jam?
Eating butter? Yeah, jam. I've definitely made jam 250 times.
Yeah, but this is better. This is your real jam.
Yeah, I mean, that I do by myself. This is the jam.
This week, we're joined by Jenna Friedman and Megan Gailey to take on the following questions. What did one Democrat do to doom abortion rights in North Carolina? When do culture wars become actual wars? Why did this week's succession fuck us up so badly? And what NBA players have the cutest kids? All this and more right now. And welcome to Hysteria, the show for people who usually ended up just doing most of the group project themselves. Hosted by two people who did end up doing
100%.
We see you. We understand you.
We are here for you.
We are you. We hear you. So before we get into the news, oh my gosh, Alyssa.
Yes.
250 episodes.
Are we in love? Does this mean we're officially in love? We've made it 250 episodes.
So I think we're common law married at this point.
Yes.
If you do 250 episodes of a podcast with somebody. Although I was on maternity leave for a bit and we haven't, been here.
I didn't cheat.
But this is our daughter. This is our daughter Hysteria.
This is our daughter. She's still here.
Our beautiful daughter Hysteria is 250 years old. And so we wanted to answer some of your listener questions. We are going to be sprinkling the questions throughout the episode. So if you want to know if we chose yours, you got to listen till the end. Okay. First question. I will read this.
Okay.
If we were to add a third to our ride or die duo, who would it be? Who would the third person?
Would it be? I feel like it would either have to be our producer, Caroline, mm-hmm. or Jay Smith Cameron.
You know what? That's really fun. That was going to be my answer, too.
I feel like
Caroline has been with the show almost as long as the show has existed. And we've all kind of grown together with the show. And yeah, I think that might be the right answer. I'm trying to think like a fantasy person I've never spoken with who I would want to be a part. I would say, Bernie Sanders would be a fun monkey wrench.
Also weird, Tracy Ellis Ross comes to mind.
Oh, she seems fun.
Yeah,
She seems fun. Okay, cool. Okay, let's get into the news. Abortion. This is a classic Hysteria segue. Speaking of fun, abortion. Okay, on Tuesday evening, the North Carolina legislature banned most abortions after 12 weeks by voting to override the veto of Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and upholding the ban. The ban will take effect July 1st. The Senate voted to override the veto in a 30-20 vote, and the House followed suit with a 72-48 vote. Here's the thing that really, really grinds my gears about this. They did not have a veto-proof majority until one suspicious Democrat switched parties. Alyssa, what do you make of that?
Is Trisha the new Karen? Erin, why is our party plagued with people who keep doing this to us? It's like, to me, she should be recalled. There should be a special election for her seat. The people who voted for her did not vote for this. Mm-hmm. And I am just, I'm sad, I'm appalled, I'm mad. And I guess just like, why? Mm-hmm. I mean, she gave this whole sort of like, woe is me speech that the Democratic Party isn't what it used to be. And that's why she's a Republican, except that she gave a speech several years ago about abortion, about her abortion. And I guess, why would you take away from other people what you yourself were entitled to when you needed it? It is so hypocritical and dark and cynical. And
Speaking of cynical, Trisha Cotham is this Democratic lawmaker's name. She's in a safe Democratic district. Her switching parties was kind of no pun intended, but sort of like a miscarriage of the electoral process. They did not vote for a Republican, and I don't think people in her district wanted to vote for abortions to be banned in many cases in North Carolina. Here's something that I want to know. Who has she been meeting with? Who has she been talking to? What was she offered?
But what could it be? What could it be?
I don't know.
She can be lieutenant. I mean, like, she can't even, it's not even like she can be lieutenant governor. Governor's a fucking Democrat. Like, what the fuck?
I have no idea. But you know what I want, though? Like, okay, so on Tuesday night in New York City, Harry and Meghan and one of their friends were pursued by, like, an army of paparazzi on scooters. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Unnecessary. Un-fucking necessary.
Trash. Total trash.
They were afraid for their lives. Like, I heard that some streets had to be shut down. Alyssa, what
streets had to be shut down. There were paparazzi on mopeds and scooters on the sidewalk, like bowling pedestrians over like bowling pins, trying to catch up to them. And Erin, here's the question. So overexposed, what are these pictures worth? Who cares?
Why
are they doing this? It's
go
so
to
insane.
North Carolina and follow
yes.
Trisha Cotham around.
There's a much better story here.
We should know who she's meeting with. Who's she talking to?
What'd she get?
Well, here's what she got. She got an abortion ban for everybody in her state because she's an asshole. I don't want to let every other Republican off the hook here because they are also assholes. But she's a stinging asshole because she's just her switching.
It couldn't
parties.
Have happened without her.
Yeah, yeah. At least buy us dinner if you're gonna fuck us, Trisha. All right. What else do we got to talk about? Ooh, what's going on in Philadelphia?
Oh, Erin. Little action in Philly. The primary was yesterday. In Philly's primary for mayor, 3 of the 4 leading candidates for the Democratic nomination were women.
Interesting.
And Sherelle Parker has won the Democratic primary as of this morning. 88% of precincts are reporting. She is the nominee. Parker spent 10 years in the Pennsylvania State House of Representatives and then the City Council. If she wins the general election, which most people think she will because Philly is a very Democratic city, she'd be the first female mayor of Philly and would have a critical role in overseeing voting in the largest city in a big-time swing state in 2024.
That is super interesting. Also, greasing the polls in case any Philadelphia sports team win or lose an important game so that fans cannot climb lampposts. That's a very important role of the Philadelphia mayor is pole
of
grease
course.
Overseeing.
God bless her if she wins. We hope she wins. But Philadelphia is a bit of an embattled city. It has sort of like Chicago vibes right now. The current mayor has said he will be happy when he's done being mayor. So she's inheriting what feels like a bit of a mess. Public safety is a huge issue in Philadelphia. So if she wins, Godspeed, wind at her back.
Yeah, you know, we're seeing a lot of cities elect their first female mayors right at a time when being a mayor seems like the
shit's
shittiest
bad.
Job. It's like, let's give women these terrible, 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 very difficult jobs that they just, it's just going to be nonstop stress. But you know what? Seriously, Karen Bass here in LA, you know, we've got Philly, you know, I guess women are willing to do the hard jobs. So that's
New
cool.
York. New York is getting so bad, a woman might have a chance here soon, too.
Oh, my God. Do you remember that election that Anthony Weiner was in and it just got totally thrown sideways when the whole his, like, problems
situation.
Came to light? His problems, the troubles. I remember Christine Quinn was supposed to be the first female mayor. Everybody thought Christine Quinn was going to be the first female mayor, and the New York Times had, like, a camera crew following her around. Because they were going to – and then they ended up making this documentary of her losing.
Yeah.
And it was – it was one of those things that maybe I should watch it now as, like, an artifact. But at the time, just, like, watching it was just like,
whoa.
I don't know, man. I didn't vote for her. Okay. Let's – what else do we have to talk about?
More fuck around and find out in the Midwest.
Yeah. So in Kansas, there's an interesting kind of – back and forth going on between the state's Democratic governor and a Democratic lawmaker who appeared to switch sides and help override a gubernatorial veto. Kansas's Democratic governor vetoed state funding Monday for a project long advocated for by a Democratic lawmaker who broke ranks to override the governor's vetoes and give Republicans crucial support for laws restricting abortion and rolling back trans rights. And the project was a $250,000 amount of money set aside to develop a site in Kansas City that was a significant underground railroad site. So there's a lot of back and forth. It's a really complicated discussion because, like, the governor is a white lady, but the veto overrides hurt trans people and hurt abortion access because of this lawmaker breaking ranks with other Democrats. But it's like, is she getting back at this lawmaker? She says she's not. Alyssa, what do you think is happening?
Okay, let me give you my theory here, Erin, because the governor is a smart lady. We are into her. And I think mostly she's just rat fucking him. She will have the project go through, but this has been his, like, raison d'etre for years, like, even before he was an elected official. And so I think she's just not going to let it be his success. Like, I think she's still going to, she's talking about how important it is. She's saying there just needs to be a little bit more research, but I think she's just not going to let it be his to claim victory over. She's just like, you can go fuck yourself.
I feel like you've probably had a front row seat to instances where politicians have done some, like, maneuvering and done things like that. Just have you?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, look, here's the problem, Erin, is that I was always the person. Barack Obama was actually like a nicer person than I was. There were a lot of people who I wanted to rat fuck. And I'd be like, oh, yeah? Well, here's what we're going to do. And he's like, Alyssa, that's not how you make progress. And I was like, no, it's vendetta with a V. But I think that she is getting him where it hurts. And I think that, you know, he can be as mad as he wants. But I know that the other representatives who support this are really mad. But I personally, not a member of the Kansas legislature or anything, but as a New Yorker, I think it's probably going to pass. And she will make it happen just at a time when he cannot benefit from it at all.
Right. And she vetoed the funding after the state legislature had adjourned for the session. And so there was no way for them to just, like, override, which kind of makes me think maybe she should have just, like, done some of her – held some vetoes until the very end of the session anyway and just, like, been a – you know, been a total rule. I mean, following the letter but not the spirit of the law, which is what Republicans do all the time. And I think maybe we should start doing that too.
I agree.
Okay. Ooh, Alyssa, one more story.
Erin, I love this story. I love this story because you know what? Let me tell a quick personal anecdote. In 2019, I had my first really, really bad hot flash. And it was at a very embarrassing moment. I was at a Netflix For Your Consideration event, and I was interviewing Christina Applegate, icon, Linda Cardellini, icon, Liz Feldman, icon, for their show Dead to Me. And before we went on stage, I started sweating like a fucking stuck pig. And Christina Applegate and Linda turned to me. They're like, are you okay? And I was like, oh my God, I think I'm having a hot flash. I'm not, this is not flop sweat. I'm having a hot flash. And they were like, you just have to lean into it because the more anxious you get about it, the worse it's going to be. So I went on stage in front of hot lights. And Erin, you've seen the jumpsuit that I wore, my favorite denim jumpsuit. And I had sweat through.
Oh my God.
Denim. It was. There was, like, a little party afterwards.
That's,
I was
like flight
I'm
suit
out.
Grade, Alyssa.
Yes,
that is, like,
I know.
You could make motorcycle repairs in that.
And I had to peel. My bra, everything was stuck to me. It was one of the worst feelings I have ever experienced. And I'm telling that story because we have had a bit of a breakthrough.
Ooh.
For women who are going through or will go through menopause, which is all of us. And it's on the heels of an article written a couple weeks ago, which is based on a Mayo Clinic study that menopause costs American women an estimated $1.8 billion annually in lost working time. This is real. People have not been addressing it for years. We have no Viagra. Well, I mean, we have Viagra. We have nothing that's been able really aside from hormonal therapy to help women with some of the symptoms for menopause. Except this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration last Friday approved a new type of drug to treat hot flashes and night sweats during menopause, making it easier for women who want to stay in the workforce. The new drug, Veozah, what a name, Veozah, blocks receptors in the brain that play a role in the regulation of body temperature. It's an alternative to traditional hormone replacement therapies to manage hot flashes, one of the most common symptoms of menopause. In the clinical trials, there were 3,000 women included, and the Veozah reduced the number of hot flashes women experienced each week significantly more than the placebo group.
Okay, so, Veozah. Alyssa, could we use Veozah in our game that we made up? Our game,
Veozah.
Car, drug, or baby in Utah?
I mean, I really, God bless a little baby named Veozah. Bet she's adorable. Or he's adorable. Gender-neutral Veozah.
I think Veozah could also be a car. I think Veozah sounds like it could be a car.
Veozah sounds like a new electric car.
I feel like there are two labs in the U.S. at any given time working feverishly, and one of them is a lab to come up with names for drugs that sound vaguely like they could be nice people names. And then another lab is Mormon influencer bloggers feverishly coming up with names that don't exist for their children. And they need to beat the drug people too.
Yeah.
I wondered when COVID was named if there was somewhere a baby named COVID and they had to like change.
Probably.
Because it's
and they're like,
oh
no, what are we gonna do now?
Yeah. Ooh. You know, Dovid. Let's name him Dovid. Well, that's really great news. I'm glad that people are finally taking the fact that menopause shouldn't be something that people just have to deal with as is, with no help or remedy, or only deal with it using hormone therapy. I think I'm glad they're looking into it. I mean, the cynical side of me is like, they're only really looking into it because they're realizing how much money women of that age would pay to manage
because
their symptoms.
There are 15 million women ages 45 to 60 in the workforce currently.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny that the wording that was used was like, for women who want to keep working. It's like, what people at age 45 are they like, you know, professional soccer players? Who's retiring at age 45? Firefighters?
Not
I think
me.
Most people who are in the workforce at age 45 are going to stay in for like another 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 30, whatever, however many years. I'm glad they're finally taking it seriously.
And let's just hope the insurance companies don't rat fuck us and that it's actually remotely affordable.
I think, you know what, this is going to sound adversarial, but I think that insurance companies should fuck people over more. Instead of just gently fucking us over, they should fuck us over harder. So more people get angrier and are like, no, absolutely not. I mean, all it takes is like one 20-minute argument on the phone with an insurance person who's never examined you, who's telling you you don't need a medicine that your doctor says you need. I feel like it only takes a couple of those before you're like, burn it down.
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I know a lot of people would lose their jobs, but how many times have you had a good experience with an insurance company where you're like, I want all of you to be well paid and have great jobs? No, they can learn to code. Okay, let's move into some more mailbag questions.
Ooh.
You want to pick one you like, Alyssa?
Yeah, let's see here. Margaret from the Friend of the Pod from Cricut Media's new subscription community asks, what do you think is easier about entering the workforce as a woman today than when you started your careers? What do you think is harder?
That's a great question. I can say, well, I guess I kind of entered the workforce in this weird sideways way.
Yeah.
I did AmeriCorps right after college, which is like not technically the workforce. I was living on like a stipend. And then after that, I was like, I want to earn money and have insurance. And so I got hired at Merrill Lynch because they were hiring everybody with a pulse who could hold a pencil at the time. And I had a pulse and I could hold a pencil. But I just took that job because I needed like insurance and some way to pay my rent. And I actually, there was a period of time where I was like so poor that I was like doing medical trials at the University of Chicago. Yeah. One time I was in a medical trial where they made me take a drug that was used for Parkinson's that the drug maker was being sued. Yes. I can't believe I didn't tell you about my medical test subject days. So what I would do is I'd go in, they would test my urine to make sure I wasn't like on drugs or had alcohol in my system. And then they would give me this drug and they would have me watch movies for like 2 hours and then they would come back and have me do these like mild gambling exercises. Like if you guess which one the red dot is under three right. times in a row, you get a dollar. Or you can, and it was like gambling basically. And then afterwards, you know, they would give me whatever dollars that I earned and then I got paid for being part of the experiment. The drug was a drug that allegedly made people act compulsively. The drug maker was being sued because people who were taking it were like, had never gambled in their lives, were suddenly like losing their life savings at a slot machine. And so they were testing to see if it increased like compulsive behavior.
I can't believe I did not know that story.
Yeah.
And also continues to baffle me that we both worked at Merrill Lynch.
Yeah, that's super weird. It was once I started, it was like, I wasn't like making bank. I was like a support staff person.
Same. I was a senior secretary was my official title.
Nice. Same. I mean, basically, I don't think they used the term secretary when I was there anymore, but it was like a similar deal where I was like, I had all my broker's licenses, but I was supporting a broker. And yeah, it was like easy to enter the workforce because there were a lot of jobs and they wanted to pay people not very much money. And actually, insurance was like cheaper and better back then. I actually think that the healthcare that I got for my first real job was like better than the healthcare that I even got through like the WGA in, you know, 2018.
I think that's true. My insurance back in the day was much better than it is now.
Yeah, it was just like really, really good, and it's gotten worse. That was a really long-winded answer. I don't know how hard it is to enter the workforce today. I can say entering journalism is really hard today. Mm-hmm. Entering media is really strange. Back when I first started, even when I was first starting TV writing in like 2017, the first time mm-hmm. I sold anything, the pay was better. Like it felt more stable. Like TV shows ran longer. You know, a lot of stuff the WGA is striking about, you know, I witnessed some of that stuff happening, you know, in the industry. Journalism is a little bit rough now too. There's always like these sort of, you worked at Vice for a while, right? And there's always a sort of like expansion implosion cycle mm-hmm. that repeats itself. And I think this is the third one that I've seen. So I think right now it's probably pretty hard to enter journalism, mm-hmm. media. But that doesn't mean it's always going to be hard. There'll be a time in like 6 months to a year where suddenly there's more opportunities, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I entered the workforce, it was the late 90s. And have to be honest, every single job I applied for was like, how many words per minute can you type? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's a thing anymore. But I think that, you know, I think that when I was looking for jobs as a very young person, a lot of it was just like, here, you can interview to be a secretary. You can interview to be a secretary. They weren't like, even like the idea of an assistant now still kind of implies that you can learn something and go further. And I think that back when I got into the workforce, it was mostly like, you'll be a secretary, you're going to learn how to type, and here is like your opportunity to be the best secretary you can be. And secretaries are awesome, but that was not what I wanted for myself. So I think now there's probably a little bit more, there's a more expansive brain in corporate America about when women are coming in to interview, that it is not just for one specific job.
Mm-hmm. I also think one thing I would say is probably easier than when you and I were both entering the workforce is I feel like, and maybe I'm just saying this because I'm a millennial, but I feel like millennials are a little bit more empathetic and have a little bit more care as bosses than people who are in generations that came before. I think that some women especially, I hate to say it, who are a little bit older tend to be like, I had to go through this, so you have to go through it too. And I just haven't experienced that when I've been working with millennial women, either in like at a who's been parallel to me or somebody who's been like my boss. I've never experienced having a boss that was close to my age that I didn't feel like had empathy for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
Okay, I'm going to pick a question. This is going to be a real favorite city outside the U.S.?
Tokyo.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. It's lovely.
I'm going to say I haven't spent much time there it's been a long time since I've been there, but mm-hmm. Mexico City. Mexico Ooh. City is a really, it's really, got it, it just feels very alive. It's a really, really it's a cool place to visit. And I kind of compare the vibes of it to, like, I'm only saying this because it's like kind of old and the weather is like heavy and wet during the mornings. Kind of has like a little bit of New Orleansy vibe, only because of the way that the air feels.
I can see that.
And there's, oh, the Anthropological Museum there is amazing. Amazing. Cool. You want to pick another question before we take a quick break?
Okay. Erin, I have one for you.
Okay.
Do you believe in aliens?
Yes, I do.
That's why I asked you.
I mean, I don't know. Look, if we were doing mushrooms together, I would talk about this a lot. I'm going to tell you. I think that there is life out there. I feel like there's no way that there's not, just like purely by the numbers. But I read this like super disturbing article maybe like 8 or 9 years ago that stuck with me. And then I watched a really disturbing TED Talk while I was like, I'd taken an edible, and so it just really like affected me. Anyway, the one article that I read was that some people are a little bit baffled by the fact that we haven't made contact with any form of intelligent life yet. And so the theory is that either the Earth is one of the first places in our immediate vicinity to develop life, or the last. So either we are just alone and like somewhere, like everything else is TK, 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 or we are floating in a giant space graveyard and we're the last ones. And that really fucked me up.
Yeah, seriously.
The other thing was this TED Talk where this guy said that intelligent life is evolving away from biology. And, you know, we're pouring more and more of ourselves into machines. Like, we're seeing, like, the next evolution of people isn't biological, it's machine. So if we tried to contact intelligent life, there's a chance that we would just contact a machine.
Wait, can I just throw something out there?
Yeah.
Maybe when we get to our 300th episode, we should do it on mushrooms.
There's a chance it will be legal in California by then. There's dispensaries out here where you can buy it.
I know.
There's dispensaries. Oh, speaking of legalizing drugs, Minnesota is like, I want to give a shout out to Minnesota. Minnesota like flipped its state legislature and now they're doing all kinds of cool stuff. I think they're about to pass like a pretty good paid leave policy. They renamed a portion of a highway after Prince. They're making the roadsides purple. They're legalizing recreational marijuana for users 21 years of age or older. It's way to go. Way to
go. Keep it coming.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll answer more questions when we come back, so stick around.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, a podcast for Lisa Simpson's Living in a World of Homers and Barts. Alyssa, since this is our 250th episode, we're doing listener questions.
Yes.
Do you have one to kick off this segment for us?
I do, Erin. I have a listener question for you. Erin, what's been the biggest change in perspective since motherhood?
Ooh, how free I was before. I had so much freedom. I could go wherever I want. I mean, I would have, like, within reason, I couldn't just, like, disappear for several days and be
right,
like, bye,
right,
husband. But I could go, if I wanted to go get coffee, I could just be like, put my shoes on and go get it. But now it's just a complete change in what I'm able to do, what I have the, like, flexibility to do and the space to do. So that's, I mean, it sounds very dark, but, like, I can do, like, baby stuff. Like, you know, I could take her to, like, a baby gym and do, like, the playground and all this stuff. But, like, it's a loss of freedom that I had lived in for, like, my entire adult life. And it's been a little bit of a, there's been a little bit of an adjustment when it comes to it. So yeah, I know it's like a dark answer, but it's true.
Not dark. It's honest. That's what the listeners want.
I hope so. if you're thinking about having a kid and you're on the fence, I would say don't.
Oh my God.
No, you should, if you want to do it, if you want to do it, then do it. But if you're like, meh, I don't know, like, you know,
it's a change.
It's, yeah, it's a big, big change. Okay, on that note, bringing in our panel, both of whom are mothers, both of whom looked pained by my answer to that question. Our first panelist is a comedy podcast queen. She hosts Megan Fun of Sports and I Love a Lifetime Movie, and she'll start hosting a new show called I Love My Kid But, starting on June 5th. Wherever you get your podcast, Megan Gailey. Welcome to Hysteria.
I said those who cannot write podcast. And so here we are.
Well, yeah, I know we can't.
I know. We're gonna strike right outside of the office after this. I brought us all signs.
Oh, you did?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, I need to pick it.
I know. Well, we got to bring the kids. I see everybody brought. You brought your babe.
I did.
Oh,
what else am I gonna do with him?
Yeah, true. I'm like, we're gonna go get our steps in outside of Disney. All right.
Oh my God, mine is like too big now. She's just gonna, she like squirms and wants to like run around and grab things and stuff. Rounding out our panel, she's a comedian, a writer with a new book called Not Funny, Essays on Life, Comedy, Culture, etc. Out now, Jenna Friedman.
Hi.
Welcome back.
It's so nice to be here and see you guys.
Yeah, so you protested with your baby on you.
Yeah, I did. And the comedic opportunity for kind of witty signs with the baby is so fun.
Did you make a tiny sign for him?
Yeah, I made a couple. One was like, I guess I'm going to be an only child now.
Someone out in LA made little tiny strike signs.
They
for
actually
kids.
Had like a little separate they table did. To make
oh my
kid
gosh.
Signs.
What?
Yeah.
Which one was this at?
Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix is the like most poppin' one. I'm avoiding Netflix. I'm going to CBS Radford. Everyone is 1,000 years old.
Ooh.
And doesn't even need to be out there, but like they've got sunscreen, apples, and angry faces.
Oh, good. I was thinking of doing Disney just because I have like a Disney-specific sign that I like. We have so much DeSantis material that they're never going to get.
Right,
yeah.
Because we're on strike and it's like, let us back.
Right.
We will help.
At Disney, you go, this is really insider, there's like a loop, too, and some of the houses are lovely, and you go, gosh, that must suck for those people in those houses, and then my friend was like, Disney owns those houses, and no one lives in them, and I'm like, well, let's fuck up these houses, though.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that is, that's a good idea. Fuck up the houses. I was picturing, when you're like, and you go around in a circle by Disney, I was picturing everyone in teacups.
No,
That would be cool, but they're the ones that know how to make rides, not us. We're the ones who write. Okay, Jenna, I want to start by talking a little bit about your book, because I thought it really dovetails well into like kind of our larger topic that we were going to get into today. You write, it's always kind of funny when a famous comedian whines about cancel culture on a platform where we can all hear them. Mm. And it sort of reminds me of how like the loudest culture war whining takes place on, you know, the biggest platform. So what do you think of when you think of what a culture war is? And how do you talk about culture war topics in your book?
So when I wrote it, everyone was talking about cancel culture. And it was something I felt like if I'm going to write a book about comedy and culture, I kind of can't avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that like the term is so nebulous that it is hard to define. And that's why it is still why we're still talking about it. Because if we could all have one consensus on it, we would be able to just like move on.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people are really able to monetize it. And so as I'm writing a book, I'm like, well, maybe I can monetize it too. And that was like my general take about cancel culture. I don't want to say it doesn't exist because clearly it does. We're talking about it. But I do think it's important to look at the context. And I write about this of like comedians under assault for the things we say. And Mae West, Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, all put in jail for their words. No comedian has been jailed since Carlin for their words. Bill Cosby's literally planning a tour as we speak, I think. Uh-huh. I saw him dead.
Well, he went to jail for the rapes.
Totally. But I'm just saying, like, the lack of account. Yes. No. Bill Cosby's like, no.
And then he got out. So.
Yeah.
And
but I'm just saying is, like, the point is that, like, the comedians are so not, like, prosecuted for anything to the point where, like, somebody who's, like, a legitimate rapist of, like, over 60 people is now touring again. Mm-hmm. So I guess just, and I think part, I also think that part of people on the left's, like, want to kind of hold people accountable is because of things that might not have to do with words, like Cosby being out of, like, there's just a mm-hmm. lack of accountability, I think, makes people want people who violate a social contract by saying something racist or whatever to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. But I do go and, I talk about people who have been held accountable. I talk about how, like, my personal belief is that women, particularly in comedy, are held to account more for their words than men are for their actions. I wrote for Roseanne for one day, which was
I remember that day—the
day that she tweeted that.
Yeah,
and she did get her show taken from her, and that is an example of somebody whose words, I believe, rightfully so, lost them an opportunity. Because when you're in a position of power and you have an opportunity and then you tweet something very stupid and tone deaf and racist, even if it wasn't her intent, you should be held accountable. But, I think something that was in your outline, the idea that, you know, where our society is so fragmented right now, but if you look at the data, we're not in a way that, like, we all don't want, for the most of us don't want kids getting shot in school. Most of us want people to have reproductive freedom. And so this one area where we can be divided is culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are larger forces at play really pushing that narrative, particularly on the right where people don't have, it's really hard to get people on your side when you're talking about wanting to support the NRA. But if you're talking about culture issues that are nebulous, mm-hmm. it's really easy to kind of bring people into the fold and get them angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's something I was thinking about as I was prepping for the show. Alyssa, do you think culture war issues are sort of proxies for other things? Like, I was thinking about the Bud Light, you know, fracas. And mm-hmm. It seems like there's a note behind the note, if that makes sense. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, look, to me, the culture wars are ignited by people who want things that should be maybe a personal belief or a personal choice to be law, right? And to be enforced on everybody. And so to me, like the Bud Light, that was people who think everyone should be hetero and married and have kids and the women shouldn't work. And there's such a message behind it. It's like, who cares? Like, this is the thing about the culture wars. They obliterate any ability to have reasonable conversations about reasonable things. Like, Jenna was just talking about guns. Okay, guns are killing kids and people all across this country. The worst mass shootings have all been at the hands of someone who had an AR-15. You can believe in the Second Amendment and also reasonably understand that people shouldn't have weapons of war. And to me, that's where the culture war comes into play. It's like there is no ability to have a conversation that is remotely reasonable because they have turned gun rights, the ability to own an AR-15, into something that they think was enshrined by the fucking early settlers of this country who didn't even have light. You know what I mean? And it's nonsensical. And I think that, like, where we are right now, it's like the ability to own an AR-15 is not actually emblematic of freedom. And you can't say that you believe in freedom and then also, you know, espouse all the other shit that they are saying.
And if you, to your point, if you make it your identity, if you're a gun owner and that's your identity
exactly.
and that's your culture, it's easy exactly. for them to kind of bring you into their fold.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Megan, what does culture war mean to you? What do you think of?
Honestly, when I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, we're talking about like MTV in the 90s. Like it felt like it felt like a throwback, because and maybe that's just because when I was coming up and that's you, I remember, you know, the Janet Jackson and the Nip, and it's these moments where people across everything can clutch their pearls a little bit. Yeah. And it's like, oh, we all know these huge cultural moments, but we don't all know, yes, the minutiae and the nitty gritty of what's actually making people upset about mm-hmm. it. And so, yeah, I was like thinking about just how people policed women's bodies and how, yes, you cannot be put in jail for certain things, but how it's not okay to do. There's this a basketball player right now named Ja Morant, and he just got in trouble for having a gun on Instagram Live for a second time. And everybody is like, this is insane. This can't be happening. He needs to go to rehab. And it's like, yes, he's making really poor decisions that are actually hurting himself more than anyone else because he's losing millions of dollars. But then you see GOP Christmas cards and every single person standing in front of a Christmas tree has an assault weapon. And it's like, okay, so why are we so mad at this black man who plays basketball, which you have said should just be shut up and dribble, and we're not holding our actual leaders to? So it's like, it's easier for us to be mad at people culturally mm-hmm. than I think it is for us to be mad at politicians, because the way we show we're mad at politicians is voting, and the way we show we're mad at people is tweeting and Instagram and going on panel shows and saying they're bad people and that's, you can do that all day, 24/7. That news cycle doesn't shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when I was thinking about this topic, it seems like the thing behind the thing always reads as, on one side, there are people who think that whatever, you know, the Eminem wearing flats or whatever, not being as fuckable anymore.
I don't know why Eminem, I was like,
right.
Yeah, yeah, I thought you meant Eminem the rapper.
Me too.
Eminem no longer wearing heels.
Orthopedics, you know? Yeah.
He's getting older. No, the candy Eminem, right, not right, being like right. hot enough for Tucker Carlson to want a bone anymore. Like on its face, it's absurd, but I think that the thing behind it is the fear that people who were served by a system are no longer going to be the ones served by a system if the system dissolves. And the Eminem being like not sexy is a symptom that this system that rewarded like whiteness, heteronormativity, mm-hmm. Hyper femininity that's enforced like culturally, they're worried that that's going to go away. And the Eminem is like a symptom yeah. of it going away.
Because people kept being like, oh, you want to fuck the Eminem? And it's like, even in defense of Tucker, I don't think he wants to fuck the Eminem, but he wants to be able to fuck a woman in high heels whenever he wants to.
Right. Has he thought about the Eminem while jerking off?
Yes.
Maybe.
She has pretty lashes.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or he just wants to appeal to people who do, because we've seen yeah. his text, right? He doesn't actually believe what he says on
yeah.
Fox.
Yeah. Or what he said on
what
Fox.
What he said on Fox.
He's going to say it on Twitter now.
He's going to say it on Twitter.
Alyssa, like, what is a culture war that has kind of manifested that you've thought initially was like very, very stupid, but that you now kind of see as having something kind of dark behind it?
Oh, God.
Like, what's your favorite culture war that we've had?
Oh, they're all awful. They make me so stressed because they're all so hard to combat, right? Like, the whole point of a war is that there would be two sides. But in every single culture war, whether it is book banning, whether it's abortion, whether it's quote-unquote wokeism, or this sort of, like, absurd projection of what people think critical race theory is being taught to fucking kindergartners, which it is most certainly not. The problem is that the crazy side is so illogical that it's almost impossible to combat in some ways. Like, it's like when we will ultimately watch potentially Trump debate Joe Biden. Like, how the fuck debate Trump? No,
do
I know, but it's like that's part of what I thought was so irresponsible about that CNN town hall, is that they brought Trump in, but there weren't even Republicans who disagreed with him. There weren't even people who didn't vote for him in 2020 or people who are potentially DeSantis or Asa Hutchinson supporters. They were just people who believed him, like who were there to applaud him, it felt like. And I think that that's what makes the current culture war. There's no honesty in it. There's no ability to have a real conversation about like, okay, why are you banning Judy Blume's books? What the fuck did Judy Blume do to you? Oh, we shouldn't talk about, I mean, because now before it's like in years past when people were banning books, there was maybe like sexually explicit content. No, periods, boobs for adolescent girls who are growing suddenly is like offensive. Like all of the things that they're banning are just things that are revered in society, it feels like, if we're specifically talking about the book bans. And it's so detrimental. I mean, it's just, it's so detrimental. That's not really an answer to your question, but that's
no,
how I feel.
I think that that's like an important point. Jenna, what do you make of that?
I think that it's by design. It's by design that we can't have these fair conversations. That's why we need to have the culture war, right? Because we need people to not be able to communicate. Because if people could communicate, then we could achieve consensus. And then some people who are making money would be making less money. I think it really kind of comes down. It sounds so vague, but I think, you know, It's so big. There are so many people that just want the populace divided and not informed so that they continue to profit off us in so many ways and subjugate us in so many ways. And I just feel for, you know, those people who think Trump is the answer, because I, you know, a lot of them are Nazis and white supremacists, but I think, you know, people are broken. And I think when you're broken and you're lost and you're angry, you cling to things like this because you can't. I mean, the Eminem, the Bud Light, like the angriest people are like, they're angry because they're hurting. Like, I don't know, they can't express themselves sexually, or maybe they're hurting. Like that one guy who was like, the videos on Twitter of that guy who, I don't know if he was like breaking the Miller Lite cans or something, thinking that they were Bud Light, and like he's just.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're like so pained.
Yeah. I would be interested to see the numbers about like who vote, like the amount of people that voted in 2020 and the amount of Americans that watched the Super Bowl, because it's like that's these are things that end up being and I think award shows are like done at least like reaching everybody. The slap, I think everybody had an opinion on the Will Smith Chris Rock slap more so than everyone had an opinion on who should be president. Like I think like they end up reaching more people because I don't know if it's like media literacy that's more accessible. Like it's like, do you like Chris Rock or do you like Will Smith? And it's like, well, I've seen their movies. And so, yeah, I thought Wild Wild West was bad. And so I'm picking Chris Rock. And like that, it really boils down to that instead of having to know like what we're going to do in Ukraine. Like it's like easier to grasp onto, you know, like Scandoval. It's a fun thing. Everyone has picked the, you know, a right side or whatever, but the layers are like, oh, it says a lot about relationships and what it's like to be a woman who's aging and what it's like to be a woman who maybe doesn't feel great about her body and a man going through a midlife crisis. Like it does have layers beyond just like, oh, these are two people on a reality show that we don't know who ended up cheating.
That one to me feels like the most innocent one, and I think that's why people like it so much, because
it's so easy to pick.
It is, but also like you're following these people, and it's not like, yes, there's like these big issues behind it, like you mentioned, like aging and living your life in public, and what does that all mean? But there, at the end of the day, it's like two people, and or you know whatever, it's 10 people, but like 3 people who are involved in like this easy to understand
triangle
interaction. I think a lot about the Dixie Chicks and how they
angels, the chicks.
Yeah, the chicks.
You know. I just wanted everyone to know that we know.
We know. They're the chicks. But back when they were the Dixie Chicks, shortly after we went to war in Iraq, when everyone in America was so jingoistic and deviating from that, like threatened this war effort that turned out to be based on lies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in order for that to go forward, everyone needed to be totally gung-ho. And so, like, the Clear Channel stations refusing to play the Chicks' music and, like, what are those? Steamrollers running over their CDs, like, was a cultural, like, expression of something that was, like, deeply insidious. We were all being lied to. We were all, like, it was a massive wealth transfer from American taxpayers to weapons companies. That's what that.
And what they said, looking back on it now, you go, wait, that's all they said? Like, they were in London, and they were like, we're here from Texas. And, yeah, like, we wish the president wasn't from there. Like, it was so innocuous.
Yeah.
And then it was like, Natalie Maines must be killed.
Yeah.
And it was on Good Morning America. Like, I'm not saying Good Morning America was saying that, but it was so pervasive, and everyone knew about it. And it was like, I don't even think everyone knew. It's the same with the Bud Light. Mm-hmm. It's like, once I heard what everyone was really mad about, I was like, wait, I'd seen that video. That's what they're mad about. Yeah. Like, it ends up being this rallying cry over nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was also an era before social media, so it was really like the dominant news sources kind of controlled the narrative completely. I think about Sinead O'Connor too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was so badass.
That was so badass.
That was like fucking badass.
To the kids listening or watching.
And again, we're talking about women. Every reference we've done has been women or people of color.
Mm-hmm. What is an example of a man who said something and got a similar response
Dean,
in an area?
When he went like, rawr!
No. Yeah. Howard Dean was like, whatever you want to call it, for just being excited.
But you mean like a non-politician?
Maybe like a celebrity who said something and was held accountable in the 90s.
Mel Gibson for like a day?
Kramer's thing was crazy. And that was like, that was an era of social media, because that video, I mean, how many times have comedians said that before that, or like done horrible things at comedy clubs that just weren't caught on camera?
Mm-hmm.
So that actually was an example of social media, but pre-social, I guess we wouldn't.
Yeah.
Like, what's an example?
Mel Gibson is like all I can.
Mel Gibson,
but it was fine. For a little bit.
Alec Baldwin, I think, but not about the killing the person when he
called his daughter a pig.
The voicemail.
Called her a little pig.
He's a gross guy.
And then we said, you know what? You'd be great in 30 Rock.
Yeah.
And he was.
And he was. He was amazing.
And he's still working now. I mean,
he's still cranking out kids, too. More Little Piglets.
Oh, my God. Well, that's his comeuppance.
I don't know. I mean, I think the Mel Gibson thing is, but then people just, like, continued to
He said, that was before What Women Want?
Or? Yeah.
Anti-Semitism.
Well, you know, I tell you what, not Mel Gibson. That's the answer to that question, is not Mel Gibson. I think one of the most interesting little, not necessarily a full-on culture like war, but a little thing that sticks in a lot of people's craws and causes people to feel very strongly one way or another is like Chris Pratt is like immensely divisive. And if you ask someone what they think about Chris Pratt, you can tell probably where they are on the political spectrum.
And how they feel about Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It was that Instagram about his, like, the healthy kid, whatever that was. I just, like, it made me want to vomit.
Yeah. So Chris Pratt was married to Anna Faris, who is a comedic genius, I'm going to say. Mm. The House Bunny.
Amazing.
Amazing film.
All of what are the Scream knockoffs?
Scary Movie.
Scary Movie.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. She's super funny. She was married to Chris Pratt. They had a son that had some special needs. Chris Pratt left her for a Schwarzenegger. I feel like he wants to Reagan. Like, he wants to become the governor of California.
Yeah, good.
And I feel like there are people on the right that are like, oh, great, a handsome Republican. Mm-hmm. And they really want to make Chris Pratt happen. You know, they want to make Fetch happen with him. But, you know, then he's posting things on Instagram about, like, very, like, pro-Trump. I don't know. Can you describe the post?
I don't remember it. It was very subtle. It just kind of, it was like, I'm really happy I have a healthy kid now or something.
He thanked the Schwarzenegger.
Yes,
he specifically was like, thank you to my wife
for
giving me a healthy child.
And wasn't she looking at him like a dog that was about to get a begging strip, like in that photo? She's just like, it was like trad wife cartoon adoration. And you know that she's not making that expression constantly, because if she is, that seems like maybe a symptom of she's going to need some neurological.
Here it is. You know I was going to have to find it.
So one, she is looking adoringly. And the tweet was, she's given me an amazing life, a gorgeous, healthy daughter, dot, 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 all this other dumb stuff.
It was subtle, but knowing yeah. that he has another child exactly. with special needs, it just made me sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's one of those things. I think Clint Eastwood is another one that is sort of like, if you ask people what they think about Clint Eastwood, you can kind of tell mm-hmm. how they feel about a lot of different things. Like, I was there for Clint Eastwood's weird empty chair speech at the Republican
right.
convention. In
you were there.
I was there.
Wow.
I was in the chair.
Wow.
That's, I was. That was like my.
Over 30, so nobody saw you.
Yeah, exactly.
Did
exactly.
someone bring the chair out? Like, can you give a. Was there a PA?
I was, frankly, bored. At, and, you know, at those conventions are. Really fucking boring unless they're scary. So like when I went to the Democratic convention in 2016, it was like boring or scary because like Debbie Wasserman Schultz had just gotten like yeah. thrown out of being the chair over some like Hillary Bernie mm. stuff. The tension was like high. And so it was like, yeah, boring and scary. Not it's never fun except Boys to Men saying the national anthem at the Democratic convention in Philly. That was cool.
Okay.
But at the Republican convention, boring or scary, it was a boring moment. I'm sitting up with a bunch of other journalists, like, being like, this is stupid. And then Clint Eastwood's, all of a sudden, he's out there talking to a chair. And we're like, what is happening? It was very weird.
So when you're watching it, everybody knew something was up or that it was weird.
I think that Republicans in general are not funny, which I'm sure you've got opinions on. Do you think they're not funny?
I mean, Trump is not a Republican. I hate that I think Trump is funny.
What makes him funny?
He is funny. He is a rape. He's most like he is a rapist.
Yeah,
right.
Bill Cosby is funny and a rapist.
And you don't think he's funny all the time.
No.
It's like a broken clock is twice.
He,
you know, like-
he says. I think he says what a lot of people think, and I think that fearlessness of just saying. And some of it, I mean, I don't want to cite things that I found funny because, like, some of them are problematic, but he just says what, and you're like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I get what you're saying. I think that he wants to be funny, like, constructing a joke with a setup and a punchline.
He can't do that. He's not funny
in that way. He's like, if he were a character on a movie I were watching, I would laugh when I saw him. Speaking, you know, like
yeah. I mean, he says the quiet parts out loud, and sometimes those quiet parts are actually funny because you're like, I can't believe you just said that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Republican politicians, like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, not funny. They desperately want to be like adored and funny.
Even
you know,
they're trying to be funny. Like,
they're not
even
funny.
The you know Jim Brewer famously like is now on the right, and you see the stand up, and it's like bad, and they're not even laughing at like what is the bad. I want to call it Dilbert, but that's that other terrible man. They have like a Fox News comedy show,
and it's Gutfeld, and it's not funny.
And, you know, so it's like if they were to have a correspondence dinner with a Republican comedian, it would not be funny.
Yeah,
I want to believe that too. I want to believe that comedy is just relegated to the left, and that. But I've seen enough. Like, and I don't want to name names, but I will off camera. But
yes.
There are comedians. I mean, you can make so much more money if you can say what the majority of like kind of angry populist. Racist people are thinking, and there are a lot of comedians making a ton of money, and they're
yes.
putting their specials on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and they are funny, but
yes.
there are like dog, they're like racist dog whistles or sexist dog
and
whistles.
And I get what you're, I totally get what you're saying. I think that those comedians would label themselves not even as right as truth tellers.
No, they wouldn't and, call themselves right because once you get into the political sphere on the left and the right, it's really hard to be funny if
yes.
you're like. Ali Camp, sorry,
mm-hmm.
or just like a political. I mean, I can go further with other people's names, whatever. But I think it's hard to be funny if you're like trying to have a political point of view. Even when I talk about politics in my stand-up, I'm like, oh, I don't want to sound like a TED talk. But I do think that, like, you know, I think we've seen because they're making so much money. There are comedians that are and also sorry, but before social media, the majority of comedians in clubs were right leaning,
yes,
and they were funny,
yes. Yeah. I mean, Bill Bill Hicks. If you watch his material now, you're like, oh my God. I mean, the stuff he was saying about Ronald Reagan at the time was like super anti what the mainstream accepted. Yeah. But he also said a bunch of real problematic stuff, and he chain smoked on stage and then died of cancer. But I think this the fact that we all got so animated in the comedy part is like, comedy is such a lightning rod for culture war issues. And I remember
it's subjective.
Yes. Exactly. And I think that there are some principles about what is funny and what isn't funny that are kind of like up for debate. And I think I remember like maybe two what is comedy cycles ago. I remember Lindy West, who was writing at Jezebel with me at the time, wrote a thing about like how you shouldn't punch down in jokes. Like, mm-hmm. and that was for a while the consensus. Like, mm-hmm. okay, comedy is like challenging a hierarchy or pointing out the absurdity of a hierarchy. But I also feel like sometimes if you are a delusional enough right winger in the culture war, you believe that you are being victimized. And so, like, you are lower in the hierarchy.
That's exactly right. And you can look at, like if you're making a joke about a trans person, well, those people are coming after me and my free speech. So I'm, like, punching up if I'm making fun of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan, you look like you had something on your mind.
Well, I just think, like, I subscribe to the punching down that you shouldn't, but then it's like, well, once you reach a certain level of success in comedy, which I am not at, you are a wealthy, you are in a totally different tax bracket. So anything you're talking about is punching down. And so then it goes, oh, okay, well, if you make $10 million a year, you got to retire. No, I think that would actually be fine. Because I'm always like, I think Joan Rivers, and yes, of course, she did some crazy things. It's like she actually was able to be relevant and funny till the day she died. And you see other comedians that have gotten so wildly successful and are so rich and so famous that it's like you guys are now just ranting old rich men. Mm-hmm. And it's not comedy anymore. It's just get off my lawn. And like your lawn is so big. Just stay in your fucking mansion and leave us alone.
It's a town. It's an entire town.
It's an entire town that you're kicking everyone out of that looks like you. So just stop.
I mean, it's funny. I think it's all like the culture war stuff is all fun and games, or like it's all M&Ms and Bud Lights and CD cases being smashed until it isn't. And I feel like if you guys all watch Succession, right?
Yes.
Okay, we're all caught up here, right?
Yes. Yes.
Here be spoilers, listeners. I feel like this week's episode of Succession was a great crystallization of the moment that something goes from being culture war to like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. Alyssa, after you watched it before I did, what did you make of this week's episode, the election night episode of Succession?
I was very troubled by it. I had a bad sleep afterwards. Guys, I have to tell you, normally I wait till Monday to watch it because it comes 9 o'clock's a little late for me. But I was like so excited. I'm so excited. I was like, it's only a couple episodes. I'm going to stay up. And I had to watch Veep and then Designing Women to try to calm down before I went to bed. And I still had bad dreams. I took my mushroom chocolate. I took an edible. Nothing was working because I found it so – it's everything you absolutely fear. And it's a show. It's not real, but it hit too close to home. It was like, oh my God, Tom's running election night on cocaine and cousin Greg's gone to the dark side and Shiv's acting like an absolute fucking moron. And it's like, she's the one person you kind of maybe thought was a little bit above it, but they're all just morally bankrupt and weak. And they picked, it was like when Mencken gave his speech, I was like, I had to fast forward. I was like, oh, I can't, this is too much. And I just, it was, it put a real fine point on what's going on because like TV is a reflection, of course, always of what's happening in the country, in the world, whatever. And that was like, I mean, I had some technical political issues with it. I was like, this is not actually how it would happen, but this is fine. And it was just three idiots picking the president. It was a lot. And then the next day I'm like, you know what? I didn't give it a chance. I'm going to watch it again the next day, but around 3 p.m. And no better. It was no better. No better during daylight hours.
I got really afraid that the torching of the location in Milwaukee, I was like, let's not give them
an idea.
You know, like, I start to
agree.
Be like, oh.
Megan, totally agree. I thought the same thing.
Yeah, it was, oh God, I was so triggered. I was in a newsroom on, not a Fox News newsroom, but I was at the Daily Beast election night 2016. And
I was at Vice 2016 on election day.
I was, yeah. I had pitched a story that I really wanted to, that I thought it'd be really funny to talk to people who are in line for Hamilton on election night, and then
I think that is very funny.
Why are
that
you? It's like funny. Why are you? You care about American history so much, but like you're missing this historic, like actual event. You're deciding to go to Hamilton instead. So I like went there with like one of our social media camera people because it's like that's fun, like social war stuff. Like Hamilton is a specific signifier, even though Peggy Noonan really loved it. but for the most part, people who like Hamilton are like on one side. So it's like, why are these people all lining up on a night of, like, our greatest victory? And so I, like, interview them before, and then I go to, like, a bar around the corner to wait and wait till the show is done. I set, like, a clock, and I was going to go outside, and the needle was just, like, going like that as the show was ending. And my editor called me and was like, you need to go do, like, this other story. So, like, I saw people coming out of the theater, like, completely, like, shell-shocked, and it was just, like, it was like, one of the worst I've ever, like, I just felt horrible. The whole city felt horrible. The newsroom was like in disarray. But Alyssa, you're right that it's just like ultimately the people in newsrooms, the people running newsrooms are like the people running the Daily Beast, very smart, very good at their jobs. Yeah. But like at a place like Fox News, just a bunch of fucking knuckleheads.
Well,
you know,
and that I think was part of the weird thing for me was that I watched the episode after that CNN town hall. And I just started feeling like there were too many people in charge of what we are consuming and what's really the truth. I went down a whole rabbit hole, but I just have to tell you, on election night 2016, a large percentage of the Vice employee base had been very pro Bernie. And I was worried that no one was going to go out and vote. And so I'm like, guys, everyone, you know, you get time off. Everybody go vote. Everybody go vote. And I mean, you guys, they thought I was such a fucking square anyway, but it just solidified my place in history at Vice as the squarest person who ever worked there. And I was like, and they're like, but isn't Hillary going to win? I'm like, you guys, of course she's going to win, but you have to vote. This is so important. And then I had to write, and by had to, I made myself do it, a letter to the entire company the next day about like why we should never take things for granted and why I was wrong. It was like, but it was just, it was when we were watching the results here in our apartment, my husband, who is very clinical and not emotionally attached to candidates or anything like that, really, except the ones that he directly works for, he was telling me how bad the results were. And I'm like, you need to watch it in the bedroom. Okay, I can't watch this with you. Mm-hmm. And then I kept going back to the bedroom to be like, have you seen anything about Dane County? He's like, bad. It was so bad. But anyway, that whole episode brought me back to 2016 in a very real way.
Yeah.
We talk about that night as if it were 9/11.
Yeah.
Because
it was.
We all, that, I mean, you know my story. I was on Colbert on election night.
Uh-huh. And, oh, yeah. Get your abortions now is the thing that Jenna said it to a microphone.
It was live. It was on Showtime. And they were like,
I did say the F word too. Was that okay?
I didn't say the F word, but okay. it was live on Showtime. And so, oh yeah, I did say we're going to be fucked.
Okay. Yep.
Should
okay.
I not say it on this?
No. Oh yeah, of course.
You could say it on Showtime too.
Yeah.
Even though you could say it on Showtime. But yeah, I mean, the thing about it that I find fascinating was just like the overall gaslighting, mostly by men, being like, things are going to be okay, everything's going to be okay, and that aftermath. And a friend of mine was in a crazy plane crash pre-social media, because he might have heard about it if it happened later. But she was, I think it was like an Alaska Airlines flight from like San Francisco to Washington or something. The plane was in free fall for like, I don't know, 30 seconds to a minute. She said the women on the plane were like holding hands and crying and praying. And she looked over and she saw a guy doing a crossword puzzle. And I think about that all the time. And it reminded me of like the 2016 election night results where I was like, get your abortions now. We're going to be fucked. And everyone's like, you're hysterical. Like, calm down, honey. And then, you know, how many years later?
Yeah, it's like a culture war until it's not. He ran on like cultural grievances and he, you know, and then, it, you know, we knew, women knew at the night of election that like We knew what was behind the cultural grievances.
I was naive until around, like, I really had, and I also, like, I know that I sound like such a broken record, but it was such a perfect storm of shit. It was like social media, Russian interference on Facebook, came whatever. It was like the Bernie, it was like, you know, Hillary not campaigning in like Wisconsin. It was like, it was just a perfect storm. And then with all the grievances and everything that kind of led to that, and she won the popular vote. And the Electoral College is a relic of slavery. I always have to contextualize it when we talk about this, because I do believe that, like, we were ready to have a female president. Mm-hmm. And like, I need to, like, remind myself of that, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. that what happened was a perfect storm of shit.
Yeah. That is indeed true. And that's what we saw on Succession this week. And I feel like that's why culture war issues rile people up so much, in addition to the, like, easy to understand, mouth breathing, daytime talk show fodder type shit. There's something behind it always, and sometimes that something can become the president. Okay, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we've got some more listener questions and I Feel Petty / Sanity Corner. And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that doesn't believe Shiv is worthy of Tom's loyalty. I don't think Tom is really worthy of anything at all.
No.
No. But maybe they deserve each other.
Yeah. Maybe they lean more like they both are wrong.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I made a joke about Succession, Game of Thrones-ing. And its very end, like, Shiv burns down the Waystar Royko building and then has sex with cousin Greg. And they're like, as a joke. And then there was like the scene this week where she, like,
you're gonna fuck me.
Yeah. She's like, oh my God, did I make it happen? Did I make it come true?
You manifested it.
I know, I manifested it. I womanifested it. before we get to Sanity Corner / I Feel Petty, some announcements for the class. We have a new merch collection at the Crooked Store, Matriarchy or Bust.
It's inspired by those awesome 90s airbrush t-shirts and the moms we begged to buy them for us.
The design makes me feel like I'm on a fun summer road trip with no traffic and no patriarchy. Alyssa, I never went to, like, the Jersey Shore as a kid, but it seems like something that you would get as a souvenir from the Jersey Shore.
The Jersey Shore or your local county fair, I definitely had a drawer full.
You did? Which was your favorite design?
Unicorns.
Ooh.
Unicorns with an airbrush rainbow.
See, it really immediately put me in nostalgia zone. And now I kind of am like, we should do a lot more merch that is exactly 100%. This vibe. The collection has tees, tumblers, and bumper stickers. Something for everyone. Check it out at crooked.com/store. Let's do a couple of listener questions.
Okay.
Alyssa, if you had one do-over, what would it be?
If I had one do-over, what would it be? Honestly, I'd have to go back to the time during COVID when I cut my hair really short and bleached it blonde, and it's taken me 2.5 years to grow it all out and fix it. That, honestly, it's the most, it's vain, but it's true.
My do-over is, like, boring. I wish I would have, in my 20s, been more focused on saving money to buy a house in California 15 years later.
Do-overs hit home.
I know. Like, God damn it. Even in 2018, if I would have just been like, I'm going to focus on doing this now. Megan, you know what I'm talking about.
We all would have known in 2018.
I know, seriously.
I have one.
Okay.
Erin, what's been your favorite part of doing this podcast?
Ooh, you know, I think there's a lot of things I really love about it, but the thing that is extremely necessary was in 2020 during, like, pandemic, the height of pandemic, it was like the only human conversations that I had. Every week it was like a built-in 2-hour conversation with several people who I like and who like me. And it felt so, I think I would have, like, lost my mind if I didn't have the podcast. How about you?
No, same thing. It's like from the pandemic lasted so long that it was like, I mean, for huge swaths of it, I did not have anything else to do other than, of course, you know, make jam, which also didn't involve people. So it was the same. It gave me something to look forward to every week.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that's how the podcast functions for our listeners. Want you to feel like you're hanging out with your pals, but you're not expected to participate. You don't have to. You can just sit back and relax and enjoy it.
Yeah, okay. You don't have to prep at all.
No. Okay. Alyssa, do you want to go first, Sanity Corner or I Feel Petty this week?
Sanity Corner for me, for the big 250.
Okay.
And for the big 250, let's celebrate Martha Stewart being 81 yes. and on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I mean, the pictures were one thing. The behind the scenes were totally another. It is amazing that at 81, she's the oldest woman to ever grace the cover of Sports Illustrated. But she was just like living her best fucking life during that photo shoot. I'm sure Snoop gave her some weed. And she was just like, pour that water on me. She like slick my hair back. She's like, she was so not self-conscious. She was so just fucking in it and enjoying it that I really, you know, on the same week, we get Martha on the cover of Sports Illustrated. The same week the FDA is going to maybe give us some hot flash medicine. It's like, this was a win for women this week.
And book club, the next chapter.
Oh, please.
Oh, man. Megan, what are you going to go with?
Megan Gailey reporting live from the sports desk. We have reached the Eastern and Western Conference Finals in the NBA. Now, it is the same Final Four teams that was in the bubble season that was down in Orlando. So that is very reminiscent of the pandemic. In the Western Conference Finals, Caroline is very upset, giving me thumbs down when I said I was going to do this. It's the Los Angeles Lakers. What? Who would have seen this coming against the Denver Nuggets? LeBron is on the Lakers. He is amazing, and we like him. Sometimes he makes some bad decisions, but I am a Lakers house. My husband is so excited. Denver, they really do nothing. They do nothing for me. Nikola Jokic is a two-time MVP, and he's really seems like a fine, lovely man, immigrated here from Serbia. His daughter is really cute, and she points at her ring finger like, Dada, let's win a ring, and she's under 2 years old. So she is watching Miss Rachel. And then on the Eastern Conference Finals, it's the Boston Celtics versus the Miami Heat. Yikes. I would say don't look at the fan bases. If you look too closely at the Boston fans, you're going to be very upset. Jimmy Butler is on the Miami Heat. It's truly crazy that they've come this far. They're an 8 seed. Their coach is Eric Spoelstra. He's a half Filipino, so he's a king in our household. I will be rooting for the Heat. Jason Tatum has a cute son, but he is also getting like older. These NBA kids that you meet them when they're like 2 and then they're at the press conference, then they're like 6 and you're like, get back to school. You know, like I don't need you traveling all over the country to watch your dad. Okay. So yeah, it's a fun time and the games are great. I think a lot of times these Eastern and Western Conference Finals end up being better than the finals because they've still got a little gas in the tank. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to watch any basketball, I would suggest during this week and next week.
Interesting. I like forgot about it because Denver makes me so mad. I like can't even. I don't dislike the city of Denver. I don't dislike the idea of Denver. I just don't like this team. I just don't like.
They're pretty boring. There is a guy on the team who like Michael Porter Jr. We got mad at him. It was a culture war thing, and I remember we were mad at him, but I can't remember why. Jamal Murray did go live on Instagram during the pandemic while his girlfriend was giving him a blowjob. And I cannot not think about it every single time I see him.
Oh, man. That's why live on Instagram is just dangerous.
Just get rid of it.
Get rid of
it. Elon, get rid of it.
Get rid of it. Okay, I will go next. Mine is like, this is more reporting from the TikTok front lines. This is what took over my FYP this week. Something known as Tattoo Gate. So there's a general like arc that these like dissatisfied customer like, you know, virality moments go on. It's like a customer gets something that they weren't, that is underwhelming. Mm-hmm. They post their interaction with the person who provided the service, overcharged them, ripped them off or whatever. And then it goes viral and then people start digging into the history of the original poster. Anyway, so this is Tattoo Gate. There was a Canadian woman named Courtney who was trying to get a tattoo. She wanted to get a tattoo of a fox, and she wanted to get a tattoo from a specific artist. She sent the artist two inspiration sketches, and the artist was like, cool, I require a $180 deposit and $1,500 for the sketch, and you get one change in the sketch. And that's weird. Like, and it doesn't apply to the cost of the tattoo.
Oh.
Which is weird, because I've got several tattoos, which you can't see. They're under my clothes. But they, you know, every time I've gotten one that involved any artistry, like, you go, it's like a collaboration with the artist. You pick the artist, you go in, and you tell them what you're looking for, and they, like, show you a couple things. And it's, like, it's fun. It's like a person who's an artist doing some cool art on you. But this artist wasn't feeling it at all. She's like, you pay me for the sketch. And then whatever. So she gets the sketch. The sketch fucking sucks. And then she wants to make changes to the sketch. Looks nothing like what she had sent. The woman who wanted the tattoo was then like told that she was basically like out the money unless she got this tattoo. She posted it. Everyone was like, that is not how this works. Blah, 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 blah. And then they revealed that the tattoo artist had actually traced the picture of the fox. It wasn't even an original illustration. And other people who had been ripped off by this tattoo artist came forward. And then a famous TikTok tattoo guy named Matt Vogt, V-A-U-G-H-T, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly or not, offered to fly her down to L.A. and give her a tattoo for free. And so that's how that story ends.
Is it how it ends? Or is this the next chapter?
Yeah, what's going on with Courtney?
I want to know. Yeah.
Did we find any posts of her?
We haven't. She hasn't been milkshake ducked.
Yeah, she's Canadian. So maybe. She
seemed like a real nice lady.
Wait, what's milkshake ducked?
Oh, it's a Twitter in-joke where it was like, everybody loves milkshake duck. Everyone's going crazy for the milkshake duck, dot, dot, dot. The milkshake duck is actually a racist. Basically, every time something goes viral that we all are like, we love Ken
right,
Bone.
Right, yeah.
We love,
right.
There's like a, there's, Jared. Yeah, there's like a beat where it's like, he posted some anti-Semitic things.
Right.
Or I don't know if Ken Bone actually did that. But, you know, there's always like, yeah. Something. You got to just be really careful before you're right. Like overly enthusiastic.
Champion a person.
Exactly. Even when we were daddying Andrew Cuomo, he got.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, he had, I mean, there was always a little that like, I don't know, I shouldn't be doing that, but he had like nipple piercing.
What?
Yeah, he had like his nipples pierced. He was giving a press conference and I'm like, and then I just saw that and I was like, there's something, you know, that's very like, I grew up in New Jersey, so just whatever. Anyway.
Oh man. Okay, so that's my both sanity corner and I feel petty. Now my FYP is going to be taken over by tattoo content for a long time,
right.
Which is fine. All right, Jenna, do you want to bring us home?
Sure. My sanity corner, I want to say, is the solidarity among the Writers Guild membership. It makes me feel sane because what's going on in our industry is so existential, but also the sanity among other unions, all of us working together, the consensus. I think there are so many DGA members who are also WGA members who are in our corner. Their SAG is in our corner. The Teamsters are in our corner. I think like the multi-union solidarity in this current moment.
Mm-hmm. IATSE?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is very motivating and inspiring. Yeah. And I also, and then, you know, the thing that's really upsetting is just the fact that Netflix and these companies don't even seem to care. They're not even trying to negotiate with us. They think that AI is going to be this, like, new technology panacea. And somebody was saying, like, this is the nature of things. There was, like, the printing press, and then there was the internet. I don't believe that AI is the answer, also because AI is like a, you know, plagiarism machine that still requires human labor to get it right, but we only just outsource it in other countries. But then also, like, I think artists will be the last to be automated, and artists are a reflection of our culture and of each other. And if we try to automate that, we all lose.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating to me that the suits over at these companies are trying to automate us when, like, it would make so much more sense economically for them to be automated first.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing I'm saying hasn't been on a protest sign, but just the way, and maybe it's because it's the Writers Guild, and as far as guilds, we're pretty capable of taking time off work compared to a teacher's union or nursing. Like, so we're a less vulnerable guild, but we're also wordsmiths. So the conversation that everyone is having, I think, is really just right on. And I love that. It's almost anti-culture war in the sense, to bring it home, of like, it's a lot of really smart people all on the same page about what is happening. And it feels very clear-eyed and deliberate. And I just hope the rest of the country supports us, because I think that it's, this fight is critical, and it ties to every other labor fight going on in the country.
It transcends the entertainment business.
It's absolutely.
In every single, it's like Amazon workers, Starbucks. Like, we have free time because we had free time before, and let's put you on our back. I'm like, throw fucking guns in there. I'll pick it for anything now, all right?
You got the picketing bug.
Yes.
You're going to picket anything. You know, it's funny, the comparisons between, like, AI and printing press and stuff, like, okay, so the Luddites were, you know, but like, people who are anti-technology are like, oh, they're Luddites. But, like, the Luddites were right. They were smashing, like, automated machinery that was designed to replace them, and it did replace them. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, we're fucking Luddites, but that's fine, because art should not suffer because of, like, studio greed. All right, that's all the time we have on episode 250. It was one for the books.
One for the books.
One for the books. Megan Gailey, Jenna Friedman, thank you so much for being here for episode 250. Such a special, fun day for everybody. Alyssa Mastromonaco, thank you for being my ride or die. And listeners, thank you for sticking with us for this entire time. And here's to 250 more. There will be more hysteria next week. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Fiona Pestana is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Megan Patzel. Thank you to Gabrielle Leverett-Diaz, Ewa Okulate, Amelia Montooth, Adia Hill, and David Tolles for production support every week. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events.